Hello, my name is Dave Emery. Welcome to our next segment. This is the third segment in an ongoing series entitled Specialized Knowledge and Abilities. The title comes from an edict, I guess one could say, a professional methodological consideration that is currently being embraced by elements of the Nazi movement in Germany. It refers to a tactic of having members of Nazi and white supremacist organizations infiltrate the police and military in order to acquire, quote, specialized knowledge and abilities, those to be used for eventually the formal overthrow of the state. We've been looking at indications that, in past segments, I should say, we've been looking at indications that Nazi elements in Germany and in Austria may very well have been pursuing these particular tactics with considerable measure of success. We've taken a look at the bombing campaign in Austria, which is widely viewed as an outgrowth of the electoral success of Jörg Haider's most inappropriately named Freedom Movement. We've also taken a look at the indications, that some of the people involved in that bombing campaign may have some connections to elements of either police or national security institutions in Austria. In parts 1 and 2, respectively, of this particular series, we began looking at the probable application of that same tactic, again, infiltrating police and military in order to acquire specialized knowledge and abilities here in the United States. We began this series by taking a look at the killing of a couple of black people in Fayetteville, North Carolina, where Fort Bragg is located. This killing was accomplished by a couple of active-duty U.S. soldiers of Nazi inclination in the 82nd Airborne Division, and there are indications that the killings of these two black people, again, just innocent strangers walking down the street, may very well have been in order to celebrate or observe the death of Robert J. Matthews, the anniversary of whose death was on that particular day. Matthews was a member of the Order, a neo-Nazi gang that murdered Alan Berg, a Denver talk show host, and committed a string of robberies before being brought to heel in the mid-1980s. There are indications, too, that the killing may have been accomplished in order to earn the spiderweb tattoo, which, at least among some white supremacist groups, is something of a status symbol indicating that one has killed for the cause. After that, we took a look at the Special Forces Underground, a truly frightening institution, which appears to be just exactly that. It is an underground of extreme right-wingers within the U.S. Special Forces, the extremely formidable Green Beret. This particular underground appears to have been based at Fort Bragg, again, the very same base where these killings occurred, or where these soldiers who committed these, committed these killings, were stationed. We took a look at the open contempt that the Special Forces Underground has for democracy. This underground publishes a newsletter called The Resistor, and again, I think the tactic of acquiring specialized knowledge and abilities on the part of white supremacist groups and Nazi groups should be very carefully considered in that particular context. I have no proof that Nazi elements may be involved with the Special Forces Underground, but they're obviously extreme right-wingers, openly contemptuous of democracy, and the possibility that, in fact, some or most of them might very well be Nazis or white supremacists should be very carefully considered. What we're going to do in this, the third segment, is to continue to look at, on the one hand, methodological similarities between Nazi and white supremacist elements in Europe and their counterparts in the United States, as well as profound and significant operational connections between them. So in addition to looking at the methodological paradigms which are held in common by Nazi elements in the United States and their counterparts in Europe, we are also going to be examining some apparent operational connections between those elements. And again, I have pointed towards this in the past. We're going to begin by briefly recapping an element that we looked at the conclusion of our last segment. This comes from what, for my money, is the best single article that I have seen on the militia movement in the United States, a partial examination of which we are going to be beginning in this particular series. Oddly enough, this particular article comes from, of all publications, High Times magazine, which is sort of a marijuana advocacy publication in the United States. Research credit on this goes to a listener who very fortunately discovered this and mailed this in to me. This comes from High Times issue of November of 1995. It is by Bill Weinberg, W-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, and the article is entitled, appropriately enough, The Militia Movement, Enemy or Pawn of the State. And even in its title, I think it raises the most significant question about whether the militias are really an enemy of the state, or perhaps, rather like the Freikorps and the National Bolsheviks in Weimar Germany, they are in effect a pawn of elements of the state that are looking to overthrow the established order and replace it with a more extreme right-wing manifestation of the same. Or of the state, I should say. And again, I think there are some very strong comparisons between the National Bolsheviks in Weimar Germany, which in turn gave rise to the National Socialists or Nazis, and the militia movement in the United States. I want to stress that the paramilitary right contains a mixed bag. Many of them are outright raving fascists and Nazis. There are also many sincere, although generally badly misinformed, conservatives within the militia movement. We'll talk about that more later on in the program. By way of effecting a transition from a discussion of the Special Forces Underground and their Resistor magazine to a discussion of Oklahoma City, the militia movement, and once again, the apparent tactic of acquiring specialized knowledge and abilities, we're going to excerpt the following segment, or recap, I should say, the following segment of this particular article from High Times of November of 1995. Skipping down, we read, "The Clinton gang, despite their support for NAFTA, prison expansion, and the death penalty, is perceived as a bunch of hippie peaceniks by the old gung-ho Cold Warrior faction of the Washington elite that held power during the Reagan years. Clinton is now the first and only president to have been jeered by the cadets when he addressed the graduation ceremonies at West Point. This kind of open alienation of military troops from their commander-in-chief is the necessary prerequisite for a classical coup d'etat of the sort that conventional wisdom maintains, quote, can't happen here," unquote. Indeed, I believe, as I indicated in our last segment, that it is in fact happening here, and I believe the political process underway in the United States is very closely analogous to the subversion of the Weimar Republic, and that in fact elements of the very government are involved in subverting the government that they are sworn to uphold. That is similar to what happened in the Weimar Republic. We will be developing this theme later on in this series, continuing with this High Times article. After the Oklahoma blast, a newsletter called The Resistor, the official publication of the Special Forces Underground, was discovered in the library at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, the Army base where Green Beret are trained, and Tim McVeigh was posted. Filled with bitter diatribes against Clinton and the Waco siege, The Resistor is apparently produced by active duty Green Beret. One recent issue included an open letter to the militia movement warning that an armed confrontation with the federal government would be premature. Quote, "Should the federal government decide to act against the militia groups and the militia groups stand and fight, they will not in their current configuration last 1 month," unquote, the issue read. It then went on to offer training in special operations for militias to prepare for the coming showdown. Indeed, we're going to examine the militias, and we're going to examine the very question that the author of this article, Bill Weinberg, raised, and I think it is a very savvy question. He asks the questions about whether the militias are really the enemies of the state or perhaps the pawns of some elements of the state. And as I've indicated in the past, I think, and in particular I articulated this in the Sons of Gestapo series, I think the political rhetoric on all sides vis-a-vis Oklahoma City is inadequate. The government and the mainstream press and the so-called progressive sector, please note the use of the term so-called, are saying it was the militias or it was the right wing. And in turn, the militias themselves, the so-called Patriots networks, once again note the use of the term so-called, and the conspiracy crowd have been saying it was the government. My own feeling is that some elements, and please note the use of the term elements, of both the militia movement and the government were involved, and that they are in turn, respectively, fascist elements within the government and within the militia movement, which are in turn connected with each other. That, in a nutshell, is my working hypothesis vis-a-vis not only Oklahoma City, but the derailment of the Amtrak train in Arizona, and a number of other things as well. For those listeners that might find my suspicion that, in fact, there are methodological paradigms in common between Nazi elements in Europe and their counterparts in the United States, as well as significant operational connections between them in their ongoing campaigns of terror, I submit the following, which comes from the very important Germany Alert newsletter. Germany Alert is only available now on the World Wide Web, and at the end of this particular segment, I'm going to give some information for the web page for KFJCFM in the South San Francisco Bay Area. That is the station at which I record these programs. The web page for Archives on Audio, about which you will hear more later on, contains references for how to dial up Germany Alert on the World Wide Web. Germany Alert is an excellent source of information about the reemergence of German fascism. The Germany Alert issue of January 26th of 1996 contains the following article. This is entitled German Connection to Oklahoma City Bomb Suspect. It's subheaded Son of Coal Aide Linked to McVeigh. U.S. extremist leader says he met with German ex-chief of staff. Before reading this article, I want to note that Germany Alert has also reported that Ewald Altans, a top German neo-Nazi leader, had in fact met with some people in the Michigan militias some months before Oklahoma City took place. McVeigh and Nichols, the two accused in Oklahoma City, had in fact some significant contacts with elements of the Michigan militias. And I would also note that Spiegel magazine alleges that Ewald Altans was in fact an agent of the Verfassungsschutz, one of Germany's domestic intelligence agencies. I would also note that Ewald Altans is in turn the protege of Otto Ernst Rehmer, a member of the feared Liebstädter Adolf Hitler, one of the most ferocious SS units. Otto Ernst Rehmer was also the individual who liquidated the July 20th, 1944 conspirators against Adolf Hitler. The Altans-Rehmer link, one of a number of hard operational connections between the old Nazis of the Third Reich and the new Nazis. This particular Germany Alert article is datelined Berlin and New York, and it reads as follows. Bear in mind the allegation concerning Ewald Altans and his contacts with elements of the Michigan militias. The connection reported here may indicate that, in fact, there is a European connection to the Oklahoma City bombing. This article reads as follows. Accused Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh has been directly linked to the son of a close friend and advisor to German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, Germany Alert has learned. Andy Strassmeier, Strassmeier, whose father was formerly Kohl's chief of staff, was living in Oklahoma handling security duties for a white supremacist colony, Elohim City. U.S. officials have confirmed that McVeigh telephoned Elohim City, a Christian identity racialist compound in rural Oklahoma, 2 weeks before the bombing. McVeigh asked to speak with Strassmeier, according to Robert Millar, head of the Elohim City compound. By the way, Millar's last name is capital M-I-L-L-A-R. In an interview with Germany Alert, Strassmeier said he could not remember the phone call, but he did acknowledge first meeting the bombing suspect shortly after McVeigh was released from the U.S. Army. Strassmeier, whose father, Günter Strassmeier, is a former general secretary of the Berlin CDU and whose brother now serves in Berlin's regional parliament, left the U.S. in late 1995 after 2 years at Elohim City. He is now in Germany living with his parents. The 36-year-old insists he did not flee the United States. Strassmeier told Germany Alert that he remained at Elohim City for 4 months after the bombing. Strassmeier claimed that no U.S. authorities have tried to contact him in connection with investigations of the bombing. Strassmeier said his U.S. attorney is Kirk Lyons, L-Y-O-N-S, an extremist who has been filmed taking part in neo-Nazi activities in Germany. While Strassmeier was living in Oklahoma, Lyons met with his parents during a trip to Berlin, the Sun admitted. Given extensive media coverage of Lyons at neo-Nazi gatherings and his reputation as a lawyer for U.S. neo-Nazis, Ku Klux Klan members, Holocaust deniers, and other extremists, it is most unlikely that the senior Strassmeier did not know Lyons' background. The lawyer has told journalists he went to visit the Strassmeyers to inform them that their son was happy and well and living in the United States. During an interview, Strassmeyer said he had no part in the Oklahoma City bombing, but expressed caution about speaking about McVeigh or the massive explosion which killed 169 persons. Quote, "I'm kind of gun-shy right now," unquote, Strassmeyer declared, again quoting, "being innocent is one thing, but running your mouth gets you in trouble," unquote. I would interject at this point, before we read the rest of the article, that it would appear that Andy Strassmeyer, by the way, himself a former officer in the Bundeswehr, the German army, bear in mind our title here, Specialized Knowledge and Abilities, would appear to be afraid of something. I don't know what. He's certainly not afraid of Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. They're both in prison, and so far, those are the only two people the government is willing to admit were involved in the Oklahoma City bombing. I personally have been more than a little suspicious that those two individuals were not the only people, or not even necessarily the primary people involved in Oklahoma City. I simply think that the logistics of that particular crime were well beyond the abilities of those two particular people. Note, however, for purposes of the present discussion, that the two men accused of the crime, Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, as well as Terry Fortier, the informant against them, were all members of the same military unit in the United States Army. So again, bear in mind, specialized knowledge and abilities. And do bear in mind that Andy Strassmeyer is the son of a cabinet member of Helmut Kohl, of course, the Chancellor of Germany. And bear in mind also that he appears to be afraid of something or somebody. And again, he's certainly not afraid of McVeigh or Nichols. They are on ice. Continuing. Strassmeyer said his father formerly headed a faction within Kohl's CDU party that always believed in the nationalist dream of, quote, German reunification, unquote. The night that Gunter Strassmeyer and Kohl were shown on television around the world at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin, celebrating annexation of East Germany was a, quote, kind of a victory, unquote, for his father, Strassmeyer said. The link between McVeigh and Strassmeyer raises numerous questions about the U.S. government's investigation. The Justice Department in Washington frequently dismissed reports that it had information of a German connection to the bombing. Strassmeyer said he and his father seldom discussed politics. When asked what attracted him to Elohim City, an enclave that promotes the Christian identity belief that Jews are the offspring of Satan and that blacks are, quote, mud people, unquote, Strassmeyer said, quote, "I was attracted to the alternative lifestyle," unquote. That is some alternative lifestyle, I would add. Before proceeding into a discussion of the militia movement, a few more items about Oklahoma City. In the New York Times of Saturday, December 30th of 1995, there is an AP story datelined Amsterdam, December 29th, and headlined Dutch Twist in Inquiry of Bombing in Oklahoma. It reads in part, Dutch newspapers reported today that a man fighting extradition to the United States is linked to suspects in the Oklahoma City bombing. But in Washington, the Justice Department said there was no connection. The Netherlands has granted a request to extradite the man, Daniel Spiegelman, on unrelated charges, but three Dutch newspapers reported that the suspect also was linked to Timothy J. McVeigh and Terry L. Nichols, the two men charged with bombing the federal building in Oklahoma City last April. One of the newspapers, De Telegraaf, said a man it identified only as Daniel S. was suspected of supplying weapons to those responsible for the bombing, which left 169 people dead and injured more than 500. The Justice Department spokesman, Carl Stern, said that Mr. Spiegelman was a convicted felon who was being extradited to face federal charges of illegal weapons possession, but that the charges were unrelated to the Oklahoma City bombing. Well, obviously, one can draw no conclusions from that particular story, but with the Strassmeyer-McVeigh-Elohim City connection, and that is an established connection, although Andy Strassmeyer says he had no involvement in Oklahoma City, and there is no proof at this point that he did, and with the Germany Alert allegation of the connections between Ewald Altans and the Michigan militia, and with that particular story, the possibility of a European link to Oklahoma City and, in fact, possible operational connections between Nazi elements in the United States connected with Oklahoma City and Nazi elements in Europe connected to some of the Nazi terror there, is a possibility that I don't think should be too readily dismissed. Indeed, I think there are some very serious questions about the integrity of the government's investigation into Oklahoma City. One of the lingering questions, and one that those who dismiss the possibility of some governmental connections to the Oklahoma City bombing have chosen not to confront, and that remains troublesome connection concerns John Doe, number two, an individual that the government now apparently is pretending does not exist. The San Jose Mercury News of Saturday, October 28th of 1995, has the following story, an AP story, datelined Oklahoma City, and headlined, "Tape Shows Rider in Bomber's Truck," subheaded, "Surveillance Camera Spotted Passenger." Videotape from a surveillance camera captured a glimpse of a shadowy figure in the passenger seat of the bomb-laden Rider truck minutes before it blew apart the federal building, a federal law enforcement source says. The footage is not clear enough to identify anyone, but it adds to the body of evidence that a third figure, perhaps the long-sought John Doe number two, took part in the attack with Timothy James McVeigh and Terry Lynn Nichols, the source told the Associated Press in an interview this week. Quote, "There's a shape in there, but they can't see a face," unquote, the source said of footage taken by a camera on a nearby apartment building. The camera picked up the shadowy passenger about 3 minutes before the bomb went off April 19th, at the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building. So again, the troublesome issue of John Doe number two, I think, raises questions that those who would dismiss the possibility of government complicity either in the bombing or cover-up simply have chosen to ignore. Again, what about John Doe number two? The possibility that there may be some elements, again, some elements of the government complicit in Oklahoma City is not one that I would too readily dismiss. At the same time, however, I think the political rhetoric, as I've indicated on all sides vis-a-vis Oklahoma City, is simply inadequate. And just as the government and the mainstream press and the so-called progressive sector have said it was the militias or it was the right wing, so too I think, and as I've indicated, I believe that analysis is inadequate and does not properly account for all observed phenomena. So too I think that the political rhetoric on the other side, the rhetoric coming out of the militias, the so-called Patriots networks, and the conspiracy crowd, which have lined up right along with the militias and the so-called Patriots networks, I believe their analysis and their rhetoric is equally inadequate. They have dismissed the possibility. They have simply said it was the government, and they're not willing to acknowledge the connections of elements of the militia movement. And again, note the use of the term elements to what transpired in Oklahoma City. And again, I suspect that Nazi and fascist elements within the militia movement and within the government were in cahoots, but that not all or not even necessarily most of either the government or the militia movements were implicated in Oklahoma City. I would also note in passing, as I noted in the Sons of the Gestapo series, that those who would simply dismiss the militias as a bunch of good old boys or Boy Scouts are not looking at the facts of the situation. This is not to say that there are not many sincere conservatives within those movements, albeit generally badly misinformed. But prior to the Amtrak derailment and the Sons of Gestapo note that was found with that, at a militia conference, there was a call, as we saw in our Sons of Gestapo series, to begin tracking the speeds and timetables of Amtrak trains. And there is no conceivable innocent motive for doing something like that. So those within the so-called Patriots networks and the conspiracy crowd who would simply dismiss the notion that there might be some sinister elements involved with the militia movements and other elements of the paramilitary right, they are simply not accounting for that as well. They're not accounting for the sinister implications of tracking Amtrak trains as well as the subsequent derailments of numerous trains in the United States, some of which appear to be due to sabotage. I would also note that elements of the militia movement in Arizona had a prior warning, according to them, of something going on in Arizona, just as there appear to be some foreshadowings of the event in Oklahoma City as well. I will discuss those implications later. We should note, however, for the purposes of the present discussion, that it is standard operating procedure for Nazi and right-wing terrorists to deny responsibility for their actions. The last item in this discussion that we're going to read is an article from the New Yorker, a section of an article from the New Yorker magazine's issue of January 8th of 1996. This is an article entitled How Nazis Are Made. It's by Ingo Hasselbach, a former Nazi leader in what used to be East Germany, with Tom Reiss, or Reiss, R-E-I-S-S. And in the segments of the article that I'm going to read, we're not only going to observe, once again, confirmation of operational connections between Nazi elements in Europe and their counterparts in the United States, but also the Nazi tactic of basically denying responsibility for the very crimes that they are enthusiastically pursuing. Skipping down, like the extremists in America, my comrades and I shared a hatred for the government, a belief that our freedoms and traditions as white men, or as we said, Aryans, were being infringed on by a multicultural society, and a general anti-Semitism which held that Jews ran a conspiracy emanating from New York and Washington. While most of these ideas could have come from European anti-Semitic tracts written before the Second World War, they didn't. Virtually all our propaganda and training manuals came from extremist groups in the United States, where it is legal to print such materials under the First Amendment. The German Constitution, adopted after the defeat of the Third Reich, put significant limits on free speech when it threatens democracy and bans the dissemination of Nazi symbols and propaganda. Indeed, I was reminded of the radical difference in attitudes towards free speech in Germany and the United States earlier this month after the shooting of a black couple in Fayetteville, North Carolina, allegedly by three soldiers from the nearby base at Fort Bragg. Apparently, one of the soldiers accused in the killing had openly displayed a Nazi flag above his bunk. Skipping down, some of the information that Hasselbach's Nazi group got from their counterparts in America, one very useful manual was actually published by the United States Army and was called, quote, Explosives and Demolitions. We photocopied it and mailed it to neo-Nazis all over Germany. But the most modern handbook for terror we received was sent from Nebraska via the Internet. It was called A Movement in Arms, unquote, and described how to wage a terrorist war against a democratic government. The movement is intentionally designed to be as decentralized and anonymous as possible, so that its members can distance themselves from acts of violence committed in its name. This deniability helps keep its members both morally and legally in the clear. Though I trained young people to hate, I could still profess shock that any of them would go out and actually commit murder. And indeed, some of the blanket and frankly pro forma denials on the part of elements of the militia movement and the so-called Patriots networks that some of their members may have been complicit with Oklahoma City and other acts of terror, I think are to be seen in the context of those comments and of those tactics. I alluded earlier to Archives on Audio. That's a tape duplication service which stocks all of the archive show documentaries that I've put together over the years, and also to the webpage on KFJC-FM, the home base station on which I record these programs. We're not going to have time in this segment to relay that information. Those of you wishing to pursue research in this field are referred to the archive shows and also to the KFJC webpage, which contains information about how to dial up the very important Germany Alert newsletter. However, we're going to get to that information in our next segment. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.